I don't know whether it is your fortune or misfortune that Radhishyam Prabhu is not here. Sri Radhishyam Prabhu has got invitation to give some leadership seminars in I2IT. So he's preparing some slideshow presentation for that, because of which he is not able to come. So I cannot substitute him. I am like a crow sitting in the place of an eagle. But still I request all of you to tolerate me. Today we will be discussing on a subject of immediate relevance. There are these artificial rains which are being brought about. So how is it being done? And what exactly are the implications of that? That's what we will discuss. So we'll discuss from Shloka 14 of chapter 3, Bhagavad Gita. So those of you who have the Bhagavad Gita, we can recite the Shloka together. Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Parjanyad anna sambhava,
Parjanyad anna sambhava,
Yagyad bhavati parjanyo,
Yagyad bhavati parjanyo,
Yagyakarma samudbhava, Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Parjanyad anna sambhava,
Parjanyad anna sambhava,
Yagyad bhavati parjanyo,
Yagyad bhavati parjanyo,
Yagyah karma samudbhava,
Yagyah karma samudbhava,
Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Parjanyad anna sambhava, Yagyad bhavati parjanyo, Yagyah karma samudbhava. Yes, someone would like to recite?
Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Annad bhavanti
bhutani,
Parjanyad anna sambhava,
Parjanyad anna sambhava,
Yagnad bhavati parjanyo,
Yagnad bhavati parjanyo,
Yagna karma samudbhava,
Yagna karma samudbhava,
Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Parjanyad anna sambhava,
Parjanyad anna sambhava,
Yagyad bhavati parjanyo,
Yagyad bhavati parjanyo,
Yagyakarma samudbhava,
Yagyakarma samudbhava. Matajis, you would like to recite?
Annad bhavanti bhutani,
Annad bhavanti bhutani, Parjanyad anna sambhava, Yagyad bhavati parjanyo, Yagyakarma samudbhava. Translation: all living bodies subsist on food grains, which are produced from rains. Rains are produced by performance of yagya, sacrifices, and yagya is born of prescribed duties. Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjanashalakaya Chakshuronmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamaiham Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Utapadakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्य देशतारिणे नमो महावदन्याय कृष्ण प्रेम प्रदायते कृष्णाय कृष्ण चैतन्य नामिने गौरत्विषे नमः। हे कृष्णा करुणा सिंधो दीनबंधो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिका कांत राधा कांत नमोस्तुते तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी ऋषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये वांछाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। हरेर्नाम हरेर्नाम हरेर्नामेव केवलं कलौ नास्त्येव 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 गतिरन्यथा। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे 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 कृष्णा। So recently the news has been full of the artificial rains which have been produced by scientists. So the image of an airplane going into the clouds with a political leader and a scientist and a chemical spray being shot into the clouds and rains showering down. The whole image is very mind-grabbing. And for people tortured by water shortage, this incident seems to be a graphic demonstration of the ability of technology to counter the suffering imposed by the vagaries of nature. Technology can relieve people of suffering. That is what the general impression has been created. Nature is cruel, but technology, by the grace of science and scientists, is so kind that technology is able to provide us what nature and ultimately, unspeakingly, God is not providing us. So the whole idea is that this incident is meant to discredit religion, discredit God, to shake people's faith in God, that ultimately people are dependent on God for everything. So a deeper analysis of the subject than what is available in the newspapers reveals a completely different picture from what is portrayed generally by the hype. First of all, the name artificial rains is misleading. They are not artificial rains because they require natural clouds. So a more specific term which the scientists use is called cloud seeding. Cloud seeding means the clouds have to be naturally present. And often it is observed that in spite of the presence of clouds, it doesn't rain. So this is because of a phenomena called supercooling, in which the water vapor directly from the liquid gaseous state goes into the solid state, and because of which it doesn't come down as rain. So what the scientists do is they say inject some chemicals into the clouds by which these either super cooled water particles or normal water particles, they start coming together. This is called a condensation nucleus, which is hygroscopic, which absorbs water and by which all these particles come together, and as they come together their weight increases, and because of which they come down. And as they come down, the particles which are lower, they become amalgamated with it. And when the weight becomes sufficient to be pulled down by the Earth's gravity, then it rains. So what the scientists are trying to do is by injecting some condensation nucleus, some chemicals, especially silver iodide, which is a hygroscopic, which absorbs water, they are trying to accelerate this process. And it seems quite impressive. You go and inject something in the clouds, and the clouds which are not raining earlier start raining. Now, the insiders in this experiment tell that cloud seeding requires suitable clouds for successful execution. And the definition of suitable, double quotes, is that the cloud may rain even without the seeding. That is the meaning of suitable. So, what is required is, first of all, clouds are required. It's a big requirement. That means where there are droughts and where there are no clouds, there is no possibility of relief from water shortage. And further, it's not an ordinary cloud that is required. It's huge clouds, ordinary cumulus clouds, which are present in abundance in the sky, are not worth the effort of doing the seeding. We'll discuss this later. And further, the cloud has to be updraft. Updraft, I mean the wind has to be going upwards. And if the wind is going upwards, naturally it will rain. So all that cloud seeding may do is it may accelerate the raining process. That's all. And another thing is it has to be super cool. So these are the conditions. So what this means is, after actually this effort, this has been a dream of humanity from a long time, that we could modify the weather according to our needs and desires. Wherever there people are afflicted by the weather, it has been their fantasy that if only the weather would obey the commands of humanity, life would be so comfortable. So the scientific basis of this started in the 16th and 17th century with the advent of Newtonian mechanics. Newton's laws, by that they thought that the more we understand the universe, more we understand the forces operating in the universe, the more we will be able to bend nature to human will. This is the underlying premise of scientific advancement. So since the start of the century, there have been some attempts to bring artificial rains. And since especially 1960s onwards, this has been going on extensively in the West, especially USA. And after years of intensive research, the American Meteorological Society, in its policy statement on inadvertent and planned weather modification, has stated that there is no positive correlation between cloud seeding and increased rainfall. That by injection of chemicals, that the rainfall increases, there is no positive substantial correlation. This is the official US government statement. And that's why the US government, the Meteorological Department, has recommended that no funds be expended on this effort, which has not produced any fruits in the past. So of course it is typical of Indians to go gaga, to be enamored by the refuse remnants of the West. What the West rejects, Indians embrace as the latest products of technology. And Indians are spending around 5.6 crores for the project in Maharashtra, Varsha. So of course, cloud seeding is, there is, as we described from the mechanism, there is some effect on the rains. But whether that increase in rainfall is economically viable is a big question. You see, as I said, a normal small cloud, it's called a cumulus cloud, which is present in the sky, is not worth the effort because it doesn't contain enough rains. It doesn't contain water to get any substantial rains. So an ordinary seeder's target, an ordinary target for this cloud seeding, is a cloud which will be 10 kilometers in diameter and 10 kilometers tall. Can you imagine? Huge quantity. So that sort of clouds are not very frequently present. So only when those clouds are present can seeding be done. And even after seeding is done and it is successful and it rains, now it is again open to question whether the rain fell because of nature or because of the seeding. We don't know. But assuming that it fell because of the seeding, still after going through the seeding of such a huge cloud, the amount of effective rain that we will get, because one thing is that the hype whenever there is some technological breakthrough is too much. It is not that parched lands are suddenly going to become green by this rain, because we cannot control where the rain will fall. First of all, you cannot control the movement of the cloud, nor the position of the cloud. Both is controlled by nature. And then even if we succeed in causing the cloud to give rains, then there is wind flowing, which will make it completely unpredictable where the rain will fall. So the rain may fall just on top of a river, or it may fall on parched land, or it may fall on housetops. So the effective amount of, so from this large cloud, say 10 kilometer tall and 10 kilometer in diameter, if you take a cloud, the effective rain that we will get on the ground is 100th of an inch mm in height. That is just enough to wet a sidewalk. So that's why the US meteorological government has said it's not an economically viable option. So we spent 5.6 crores on Project Varsha. Now whether the crop yield is going to reflect or be at least commensurate with the amount of expenditure spent, amount of expenditure is a big question. So firstly, there is no assurance that the cloud seeding has produced the rains. And secondly, even if the cloud seeding has produced the rains, whether it is economically viable is a big question. And thirdly, American meteorologist Chuck Doswell, he has written a very persuasive article about weather modification. So he says, it is the historical testimony that whenever humanity has intervened in natural phenomena with some intention for desirable results, there have always been unintended consequences also. Unintended consequences is a euphemism for disasters. So, for example, when the crops were not giving sufficient yields, what scientists did was, they used fertilizers. And it seemed impressive. The crop yield increased 1.5 times, 2 times sometimes. And it was very impressive. But little did either the scientists or the farmers know what they were in for. Practically all the land that was cultivated using artificial fertilizers has now turned infertile. It has become barren. So mass soil infertility results from using artificial fertilizers. This is just one example. There are hundreds of examples. When the first vehicle was invented, people thought, oh, very nice, we can move out faster now. No one thought that millions of people will have to pay for heart diseases because of that vehicle, because of the pollution caused by that vehicle. So this is just two examples I am giving. We can give hundreds of examples of unintended consequences of technological intervention in nature. When we try to tamper with nature, there are many unintended consequences. So now in this particular case, scientists have said that several severe consequences can result from artificial rains. Among them is rain suppression or flooding. That means when we tamper with nature and we try to forcibly extort rains, the rains may completely stop. Rain suppression may occur. Or it may rain too much and it may cause flooding. Another way, it may cause hail storms. Because the water is super cooled, if it transforms into hail, and then if the hail falls, the hail can be damaging. So you're walking on the road and a big mound of ice forms on the head, people die because of that. So hailstorms can occur. And the third is silver iodide toxicity. Silver iodide has been rated by the US Pollution Department as a grade C pollutant, which is extremely detrimental for soil and water. Now that is the hygroscopic chemical which is used. So what happens is, when the silver iodide comes in, then it will go, water we cannot control. It will go into the soil, then it will come as grains, it will be in the drinking water. So those supporting artificial rains, cloud seeding, they say that the quantity of chemicals is too small. The quantity of the chemical is too small to cause any harm. But actually the whole process requires concentration of the chemical. It may be very small, but it has to be present in the rains. So rains will go everywhere, it will go into human systems eventually. So of course, the argument is that there is no scientific evidence to demonstrate the harmful effects which are being talked about. So then taking the same logic around, there is no scientific evidence demonstrating the benefits of this technology. As we discussed, the US meteorologist said that, so if you are saying that scientific evidence is not supporting the harms, then there is no scientific evidence supporting the benefits also. If you see, taking a comparable example from drugs, whenever a drug company wants to introduce a new medicine, what they do is, they have to test the medicine first for its efficacy and for its safety. Efficacy means you give it to patients and check whether it cures the disease, because the natural healing system within the body itself may cure the disease. So that's why they have a control group who are given the medicine and the other group who are not given the medicine. This is how the efficacy is checked, whether the medicine is causing the cure or it's just natural cure. So like that, if you want to test the efficacy of this cloud seeding, then somewhere the chemical should be inserted and somewhere nothing should be inserted into the clouds. And we should see whether it is really the clouds which are seeding which is causing the rains, or naturally the rains are occurring. But that has not been done. And another thing is safety. Now, the drug company has to make sure that the drug does not cause any harmful side effects. Only after the tests have been verified, not just by the drug company, by the governing body of medicine in the state, then the use of such technology, use of these drugs is ratified, is approved. And the important thing to note is that all this expenditure has to be borne by the drug company. This expenditure for new medicines is not borne by the taxpayer. It is borne by the drug company. So, but it is a travesty of justice that the taxpayer's hard-earned money is being used to experiment with a dubious technology with questionable benefits and unexamined harms. This is taxpayer's money which is being used for this. The technology has not been tested to see its benefits. Its harms have not been examined. Still, the taxpayer's money is being used for this. This is the worst part of it, with the taxpayers being used as a laboratory rats. Isn't it? It is the people who drink that water, they will have to suffer the disease if the disease occur. So it is a travesty of justice. And still, in spite of this whole thing, people are thinking, see how technology is advancing. So this is colossal cheating, complete misrepresentation of the reality, what is behind the hype. So in this way, we discuss 3 points about this technology. First of all, there is no established correlation between seeding causing rains. Even if seeding causes rains, whether those rains are economically viable is not known. And even if the rains are economically viable, the harmful side effects of that have not been examined. So of course, the sentiment behind this endeavor to provide relief to those afflicted by droughts, that sentiment is appreciable. But the sentiment has to be directed in a proper way. In medicine, there is something called treating the symptoms, and there is another called treating the cause of the disease. So this is basically, we are trying to treat the symptoms without understanding the cause of the disease. Actually, Western science and society specializes in treating the symptoms and neglecting the cause. So we will examine from the Vedic perspective, what is the cause of this whole phenomena? First of all, as science has been understanding nature around us, science is finding out how much actually humanity is utterly dependent on nature. The scientific magazine Nature, it did a financial survey of how much mankind is actually dependent on nature. So they consider the obvious natural products like water, air, food, lumber, it's wood, and then minerals, oil, which we get from nature. They also considered the cost of natural forces which are depleted by our activities. So for example, soil infertility, treating the soil like that. They also considered the natural products which we get from nature's entities, nature's employees, like bees give us honey, or for that matter silkworms gives us silk. So the total amount which this Nature magazine computed was astounding dollars 18 trillion to 54 trillion per year. This is more than the budget of even the biggest nation, practically speaking. So that is the amount which we owe to nature. Now this is not considering the sunlight. The sun is the source of all energy. Dr. Edwin Kessler, he has computed just the amount of sunlight required to illuminate and energize the state of Oklahoma, which is just 200,000 kilometers square. That is a mind-boggling $60 billion daily. So this is the extent of humanity's dependence on nature. So we walk around and we think that technology has conquered everything, but can Prabhupada would ask, can your factories produce food? They can produce nuts and bolts, but can we eat nuts and bolts? Even the scientists who argue against the existence of God get the strength to argue against the existence of God with the food provided by God. So we are completely dependent on nature even now. But rather than being grateful to nature, what modern society is doing is trying to extort nature, forcibly extort the resources from nature. And that too with the presumptuous notion that we are advancing by doing so. Of course, many thoughtful people agree that we are dependent on nature. What is often a little more difficult for them to appreciate is that behind nature there is God. Srila Prabhupada would say that it is generally accepted that nature is like the mother and we are all the children of nature. But Prabhupada would ask, how can the mother produce a child without the father? So if nature is the mother, then God is the father. And so ultimately nature is able to provide us everything because God is controlling nature. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, Mayadhyakshena Prakritihi Suyate Sacharacharam. Everything that is produced in nature, all moving and non-moving things, are produced by me. It is I who am supervising nature. And because of my supervision, everything is produced. Of course, this may appear logical, but scientifically minded people were highly skeptical about this. So, till recently, in the 1960s, in a place in Scotland called Findhorn, a family started growing amazing vegetation and flowers on barren sandy soil. Sand, as you know, cannot produce anything. But on that, either the soil was barren or sandy, they started producing cabbages and broccolis, which were almost too heavy to lift. So people started wondering how they are able to produce this. So the owner of that farm, Dorothy MacLean, she said it is because of her ability to communicate with the devas controlling the plants. So she communicates with them and she appeases them through prayer and she seeks their guidance how we should nurture those plants. Of course, scientists did not accept it. But what they could not understand was how such miraculous productivity was coming from land which was scientifically considering completely unproductive. So many people came to see it and they were wonderstruck by seeing it. And though many people among those visitors, they stayed on. And that is how the Findhorn community has been formed. The Findhorn community is the pioneer of what is called New Age Gardening. This New Age Gardening, what does it mean? It means that the basic understanding of these New Age gardeners is that we can't just get from nature the things that we want by just providing material substances to it, by water. They understand that there are spirits controlling these plants and shrubs and trees. And by communicating and harmonizing with those spirits, then we will get the optimum productivity from the land, from the garden. In fact, seeing the prosperity of Dorothy MacLean, a similar community was started in Perlandra in Virginia. And now this New Age gardening is becoming increasingly popular. If you go to any trendy bookstore and you look for books on gardening, you will find books like the Deva Handbook. Say, utilizing nature's subtle energies for optimum gardening, or they will find gardening tips from the nature devas. So many books like this we will find. So this is just an indication of how there is consciousness, there is conscious personality controlling nature. Of course, this understanding is very rudimentary compared to the understanding presented in the Vedic scriptures. The Vedic scriptures explain that it is not just some plants and some shrubs or some crops which have deities controlling them. In fact, the whole cosmos is controlled by the supreme conscious intelligence, by God. And the Vedic society and culture are based on the understanding that harmonizing with nature is complete only when we harmonize with God. Of course, in modern society, people are in harmony neither with God nor with nature. Some people are thinking that we should try to harmonize with nature. That's a difficult task, considering the kind of lifestyle which science has engendered. But still, the Vedic culture understand that harmonizing with nature is incomplete, because behind nature there is God. So we can harmonize with nature fully only when we harmonize with God. So when the scientific, when the magazine Nature presented the bill to nature, as that the article was titled, the bill to nature. So when they presented the bill to nature, it was just a dramatic gesture by some ecologically concerned scientists to demonstrate how much we are dependent on nature. But Vedic culture takes this bill for real. The Vedic society and Vedic science is based on the understanding that just as when we take facilities from the state government, we take water supply, we use the roads, we take facilities from the state government, we have to pay tax for that. So similarly, when we take facilities from the cosmic government, which is headed by God, we owe a bill to God. We actually have paid, we have to pay tax to the cosmic government. This is our cosmic duty. And negligence of this cosmic duty results in shortage of natural supplies. Just as if I don't pay for the telephone bill, what will happen? 1 month, 2 months it may go on, but after that telephone will be cut off. Similarly, if we don't pay the cosmic bill, then natural supplies will be cut off. Then we won't get rains. Or if we get rains, they will be erratic, unpredictable. They will be rained in such a way that they will not nourish the earth. They will not produce crops. So what we are trying to do, what modern science is trying to do now is that rather than harmonizing with God, it is disharmony with God which has resulted in the present shortage in water and other natural resources. But rather than harmonizing with God, we are going in further disharmony and trying to exploit the resource of God. So it is like, just imagine the situation now. So if a person is not paying the water bill, so the water supply is cut off. So then what he does is, if the water supply is cut off, you are not providing water, I will break the public water tank and I will take water from there. So he will become even more criminally culpable for that. So his crime increases further. So that is what society is doing now at present. So nature has cut off the supply of natural resources because we are not paying the cosmic bill. But rather than trying to pay that bill, what is being done is daylight robbery. Okay, daylight, or we can say skylight robbery. In the sky we are doing robbery. So this will result in further suffering. The history is full of incidents of how natural calamities have completely wrecked civilizations. According to historians, what is now the Sahara Desert, a completely barren land where practically no life can survive, that was at one time a lush green land, just a few thousand years ago, maybe 10,000 years ago. But because the Nile changes direction, a complete land became a total desert. So humanity has no power to combat the upheavals created by nature. So of course, it is not being cruel that if people are suffering, it is not the desire of the followers of the Veda that people, if they are suffering because of drought, they should continue to suffer. No, but they have to understand how to rectify that suffering. If we go further in the wrong direction, then we are doing disservice. So for how can we actually pay this cosmic bill? So that is told in the shloka. Shloka says, Annad Bhavanti Bhutani. And all living beings subsist on food. This is universally accepted. And the next premise is also accepted. That Parjanyat Anna Sambhavaha. That Anna is produced by Parjanya. By rains. This is also accepted. We know that if you give rains, then there will be no prosperity. Now the next thing is crucial to the discussion, to the situation today. Yajnat Bhavati Parjanyo. These rains are produced by yagya. So some Vedic research institute, they have done a correlation by finding that if you do yagya with the ingredients mentioned in the Vedic scriptures, like ghee and a particular kind of food, and you put grains into it, then what happens? The kind of gases that are released, they create conditions conducive to rainfall. So this research, which is in the early stage now, this research is supporting the performance of widespread yagyas. Of course, now many people, when they hear about yagya, they are appalled at what they think is gross wastage. You get hard-earned money to purchase ghee, to purchase grains, to purchase silk, and you just put it into fire. And what happens? It gets converted into ashes. People feel, really, this Vedic ancients were grossly foolish. How could they waste so much money? And they consider that to be religion. So especially for the Western, for the Britishers and other Europeans who came to India, this yagya was a graphic symbol of the foolishness of Indians. They thought these Indians really need to be delivered by the message of Christianity. They are in pathetic ignorance. That was their understanding. But considering from a different point of view, if you consider a Vedic ancient, a person from the Vedic age, if he is transported into the modern times, he will be appalled to see how much value we ascribe to pieces of paper. Now, our currency is basically pieces of paper. You know, in USA, after the Second World War, there was a big boom in the economy. But after the war stopped, the whole economy went down. So there was a Great Depression. And at that time, the value of the dollar got depreciated so much that people would bring buckets full of dollar notes, and they would throw away the dollars and sell the bucket to get some money, to get some food grains. So this is unbelievable, but this is a historically documented fact. So our medium of exchange is basically paper. And so a person from the Vedic age will be appalled. How much value do you ascribe to paper? He will think, you know, you are using gold, you are using silver, and all that you are giving up in exchange for some pieces of paper. You know, if tomorrow the Indian economy crashes, all the money that we will have in bank will be useless. Because it will have no value. We'll just have some pieces of paper with which we can do nothing. This has happened in USA, not very long ago, 60 years, 50 years ago. So the point is that the medium of exchange is extremely dependent and determined by the prevailing culture. So just as our medium of exchange, paper, is incomprehensible to a person from the Vedic age, similarly the Vedic medium of exchange, fire, is incomprehensible to a person educated in the modern system. So the point is not the medium of exchange, but the principle. What is the principle? The principle is that there is something as a medium of, which is served as a medium of exchange, for which we give valuable things, and in return for which we get valuable things. It's like where to get money, we may give some valuable things. People give their time, they give their energy to earn money. And in return for money, they get valuable things. They get food, they get clothing, they get shelter, they get the necessities of life. So similarly, according to Vedic science, the principle is important. So we give something valuable. We give what is dear to us. We use our hard-earned money to produce ghee, to purchase or produce grains, silk, and then we offer it to the medium of Agnidev. So this is again a difference in vision between the moderns and the ancients. Moderns just see fire, but the ancients see the fire as an embodiment of Agnidev, the deity in charge of fire. And Agnidev is considered to be the medium, the person who actually transports our offering to the gods and ultimately to the Supreme Lord. So the principle here is that just as in exchange for money we get something valuable, and in exchange of money we get something valuable. So similarly, in exchange of offering into fire, we give something valuable, that is grains, ghee, and in return for performing this yajna, we get prosperity, we get rains. When yajnas were performing properly, the kind of prosperity that was there is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. During the reign of Maharaj Yudhishthir, it is described that kamam vamarsha parjanyo sarva kama dughamahi shishishu jasma varjan gava payaso udaswatir muda. It is described that kamam vamarsha parjanyo, that all the desires of all the people were satisfied by parjanyo, by the shower of rains. What happened by rains? When the rains fell, sarva kama dughamahi, all the requirements of life were provided by Mahi. Mahi is the earth, Mother Earth. And what was the extent to which they were satisfied? He says, Shishishu cha smarajan gavaha, at the cows, they would eat the succulent grass and they would produce so much milk that the meadows would become moistened by the milk coming out from the udders of the cow. So at that time, the rains would be just ideal. Described as rains, it would never rain in daytime. It would rain only in night time, so that people's normal activities and duties will not be disrupted. And it will rain only so much as is necessary for the crops. Oh, if it rains but it doesn't rain enough, then what happens? Then the crops don't grow. If it rains too much, then it's flooding. Then you can't have. And it would never rain at the wrong time. Now if it rains in, say, at the time of harvesting, then the crops which have actually been cut, they get rotten. So it would never rain at the wrong time. Now again we see the knowledge filter. See, knowledge filter, we have water filter, there is a knowledge filter. What is the knowledge filter? This is the primary stumbling block in a systematic understanding of Vedic science, of Vedic philosophy. See, knowledge filter means, in a water filter, what do? We take what we want, that means we take pure water and we reject the impurities. So this is scientifically accepted that in the study of ancient cultures throughout the world, modern science has exhibited a knowledge filter. Knowledge filter means that whenever we study some ancient culture, we accept the things which appear reasonable to us. And those which are unreasonable, they call them mythology. These are imaginary. So Prabhupada would say, this is like Ardha Kukut Nyaya. Ardha Kukut Nyaya means that I have a hen which gives me a golden egg. So I like the egg very much, but then I don't like the mouth of the hen because I have to feed that. So I think I'll just keep the tail of the hen and I chop off the head. What happens? I don't get anything. So this is what has happened with the Western and the modern and largely the Indian approach also to study the Vedic scriptures. They accept things which are acceptable and they reject things which they think that they are unreasonable. And because of this, we get no benefit. So now the Vedic culture describes how when the yajna was done, there was so much prosperity. And we say that this is, and the scientists will tell us, or the scholar will tell us, this is mythology. But we see even India was so prosperous a few thousand years ago. You say, what was that song? Jis desh mein, no, that was song. Jiske dal dal par jo chidiya, sone ki chidiya rehti hai. You would say like that. In fact, if you see, just 500 years ago, the country that is the wealthiest in the world, USA, that was discovered when people were searching for India. Isn't it? So people were searching for the wealth of India and then they discovered America. And now Indians are searching for the wealth of America. So India was so prosperous just 500 years ago. So this prosperity was there because in Vedic society taught people how to be in harmony with nature by being in harmony with God. So this sort of prosperity results. Stunning prosperity. India is incredibly endowed even today with natural resources. The kind of resources India has, very few nations have. So what we are trying to understand is that it is by the performance of yajna that prosperity results. So of course in the present age, it is explained that yajnas, especially in the form of fire sacrifices, cannot be performed. Because those fire sacrifices require massive expenditure. Because it's not a, sometimes people do in their houses some small yajna. So they have this big sort of kunda, and then they put some ahuti into that. But the Vedic yajnas were not like that. In fact, there is one Shivala Sastra, which is actually a Vedic treatise of mathematics. So this Shastra was this elaborate systematic and advanced mathematics is there in that. So even the scholars were studying, they were amazed at the kind of mathematics which is there. But this whole mathematical text was used for the purpose of designing fire sacrifices. So the fire sacrifices, the yajna kund would sometimes be hundreds of meters large, and it would be precisely designed. How much should be the dimension, how much should be the length and breadth ratio, how much should be the, because it's not just one fire sacrifice, there are inner layers. So everything is precisely defined. And not only that, the amount of expenditure required to do the ahuti, to offer ghee and to offer silk, that is prohibitive in the modern times. And on top of it, even if somebody says, I am ready to foot the expenditure, still what is required is very systematically trained, proficient Brahmins. Now, Brahmin is not by birth, Brahmin is by qualification. So at that, in the Vedic yajnas which are performed, the mantra has to be chanted to precise pronunciation. The Srimad Bhagavatam describes a narrative where a yajna was performed in which the word which is supposed to be uttered was Indra Shatroho, but the word that was uttered was Indra Shatroho. So instead of short meter, it was a long meter. And what happened? So the yajna was performed to get a person who would kill Indra, but the result of the yajna was a person who was killed by Indra. So the result can be completely opposite if the yajna is not performed with 100% precision. And because there are no Brahmins in the present age, you know, the Brahmins at that time, what they would just by chanting mantras, they would get Agnidev to appear over here. Nowadays the Brahmanas, even with matchsticks, they cannot light the Agni. So that is the kind of Brahmanas we have. So that's why these yajnas cannot be performed. But in the Bhagavad Gita itself, 10th chapter, the Lord explains, Yajnanam japa yajnosmi, that among all yajna, I am the chanting of the holy names. So the yajna that is recommended for this age is the chanting of the Mahamantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So when this yajna is performed, then all prosperity results. Now people find it very difficult to understand. I am chanting Hare Krishna over here, how will that cause rains? People find the connection very difficult to pursue. But consider an analogy from medicine. Suppose there is a village illiterate, you know. He is having some severe pain in his hand. You know, his hand is really burning. And the doctor gives him a medicine. You put it in the mouth. Hey, my pain is here, not in the mouth. The doctor says, you just take it. Hey, no, my pain is here. You don't understand. You are foolish. No, that is the mechanism. You take oral medicine, the effect is on the hand. So there is a science behind it, which an uneducated person cannot understand. That by putting a medicine in the mouth, the result will be that the wound in the hand will be cured. So similarly, a person who is not educated properly in Vedic science, he cannot understand how by my performing in chanting over here, the rains will result over there. This is a much deeper science. It's not as simple as understanding the connections of the veins in the body. It's a much subtler and deeper science. But this is a science. So when this science is followed, then actually prosperity results. So unfortunately, instead of trying to harmonize with nature, when actually nature is cutting off the supply, what we are doing is, what science is doing is, actually trying to exploit nature more. So, one journalist here sarcastically said that disaster is big business for many people. Now, whenever there is a disaster, it becomes big business. Especially there are some, you know, many of the wars which are caused, they are caused not because of some reasons. Now, for example, the Vietnam War, which is a black patch in American history. But there was no need for that war. Even if the Russian nation conquered Vietnam, USSR conquered Vietnam, Vietnam was not very richly endowed with natural resources. It would make no difference. But the problem was that during the Second World War, the ammunition industry was in a big boom. And if there is no war, then the ammunition industry doesn't get any profit. So the ammunition industry pressurized the US government to start a war. This is documented in American history. And that's why the US youth went into rebellion. There was practically an internal civil war in America at the time of the Vietnam War. Because the youth understood. They said, why should we butcher so that some wealthy people become still wealthier? So this is politics behind it. So that's what we see now also. This is just this idea of trying to get rains is just a election stunt. It's a stunt to get people to show how we are doing so much for you, by getting rains. But it's not going to benefit anyone. Because the state of affairs in the state as well as in the nation is so bad. So somehow try to distract the attention of people from the sorry state of affairs, do something dramatic. What is that? Produce some rains artificially. And people don't think of the real problems. People just, the government is doing so much, they are producing rains for us. And people will give them votes. So just an electoral stunt. So unfortunately, science has become like a servant in the hands of politicians today. So first of all, science is itself, as we discussed, it is not guaranteed that science will provide benefits. And if science is used by politicians, we can imagine what will happen. Now, politicians are known to be, as one thinker has said, politician is the last resort of scoundrels. Politics is the last resort of scoundrels. So if politicians start using science, what will happen? One shudders to think of that actually. So anyway, what can we do? In cancer, when a person gets cancer, there is one cancerous cell which spreads and it reproduces and eventually if it is not checked, it destroys the whole body. But if cancer is to be cured, there is a healthy cell. If there is one healthy cell, that healthy cell reproduces. And that, actually the reproduction of that healthy cell produces health in the body. That healthy cell reproduces, it produces a tissue. The tissue expands and produces the organ. And the organ ultimately results in the production of a healthy body. So like that, the whole society is in a diseased condition now. Because no one is harmonizing with God, no one is obeying God. But if we become like a healthy cell, now if we start doing this Sankirtan Yagya, if we chant Hare Krishna, if we start harmonizing ourselves with God, then we will become like that one healthy cell. Actually, in an age of hypocrisy, if even one person lives according to principles, the effect of that is enormous on the general people. So if one person lives a principled life, people around him see that. And they also start living a principled life. And then, just as the healthy cell reproduces and cures a person, similarly, the social body which has been completely diseased because of godlessness can be cured if we ourselves become godly. If we ourselves harmonize with God, if we chant Hare Krishna regularly, and we tell others about chanting Hare Krishna, we give this message to others, then society can still be reformed. We see that what Srila Prabhupada, one person, when he went to America, he had no money, he had no contacts, he had no organizational support. And what he was going to tell the Americans was actually totally against their culture. But what he was going to tell them was that you give up meat eating, you give up intoxication, you give up illicit sex, you give up gambling, you chant Hare Krishna. But they did that. They did that. And they became happy. So from that one person, Srila Prabhupada, who had the faith in the Vedic scriptures, who had the conviction that this is what is the truth, he became a champion of truth. And now today there is a worldwide organization with millions of people experiencing divine ecstasy by chanting the holy names of the Lord. So this is what we can do. And ultimately, the Vedic scriptures don't just talk about material prosperity. They don't just talk about the wealth of the body. In Vedic society, more than the wealth of the body, what is considered important is the wealth of the soul, the wealth of the heart. The wealth of the heart is devotion. So the process of yajna, it just doesn't nourish the body. Actually, yajna ultimately awakens our devotion to God. And when that devotion is awakened, then actually a person really becomes happy. People who have a lot of money, but if their hearts are broken, if there is no loving reciprocation, what is their money going to do for them? With all their money, they live in a comfortable state of misery. They are miserable, but they are comfortable. But a person is still miserable. So really, just bodily wealth is not what Vedic culture talks about, or not what Vedic science provides. It provides wealth for the body and wealth for the heart. So that is what we ultimately, that is the ultimate fruit that results when we chant Hare Krishna. So I just conclude with one incident of how a person with the wealth of the heart, of how people, those who have the wealth of devotion, they are unperturbed under all circumstances. So, and they can be happy under all circumstances. In the early days of ISKCON, the devotees would do book distribution. So at one time they were doing distribution in Pennsylvania. They had gone to a city over there called, I think, Brooker or something. So there, they, to do the book distribution, they had got permission for the sheriff. But the sheriff and the mayor were at loggerheads. So suddenly the devotees were doing, they were chanting and singing and they were distributing books. So the mayor sent some police officials and they said, you are doing illegal activity. They were arrested. And just a few minutes ago, they were happily dancing, and a few minutes later, they found themselves in prison cells. And the door was clanged shut and the lock and the key was turned. So they were dismayed. That day happened to be a Sunday. So when it was Sunday, they were thinking that in all ISKCON centers all over there, there's Sunday love feast program. But all the devotees, they come together and they have a ecstatic devotional program. They sing, they dance, they have prasadam, they hear Krishna Katha, and they're very happy. So these devotees were really, first of all, they had been arrested. And secondly, they were going to miss the Sunday program. So they were really dismayed. Then suddenly one of them, he remembered that actually devotional service can be performed in the mind also. Krishna accepts Manas Puja. So as I said, ultimately what we have to offer to Krishna is our consciousness. That's what we offer when we do Japa. So of course Manas Puja cannot just be performed by anyone. Manas Puja can be performed by a person who actually offered the physical things when he had the opportunity to. I cannot say that I have lakhs of rupees, but I do Manas Puja. I don't give one paisa to God. That won't do. So if somebody has a lot of money, he offers it. But somehow if he loses his money, then even if he offers in the mind, then that will be accepted. So now these devotees, they were doing devotional service, but they realized that now we are not allowed, we cannot do. So we will have a Sunday feast program in the mind, they decided. So as soon as the devotees said, they all became jubilant. So let us cook the Sunday feast. So in the kitchen, the prison cell became transformed into a kitchen. All the devotees started cooking in their mind. So one devotee said, I'll cook rasgullas. Other devotee said, I'll cook puris. A third devotee said, I'll cook pulava. A fourth devotee said, I'll cook halwa. So like that, they all started cooking. Now, the devotees were so jubilant, they thought, now I'll cook and I will eat. So they were cooking and they thought, now we'll cook and then we'll offer to Krishna. So they created an altar in the mind. And while this offering was going on, so everything in the mind. But they decided to have a real Sunday feast class. So one of the devotees started giving class and all the devotees were sitting and hearing. And then, as all this was going on, then after the class they had kirtan. And they were all happily singing and dancing. Now these, all the officials, all the prison guards, you know, they were scowling. They're looking at these people, you know, these people, see, we are outside the prison and we are so miserable. These people are inside the prison and they're so happy. They couldn't figure it out. And then the devotees, they had the lecture got over and they decided to have prasad. So all of them sat down, they started serving prasadam. And then everybody was saying, please take over. It's all going on in the mind. So then after the Sunday feast got over, one of the devotees commented, this was the first Sunday feast which I had in which everything was cooked to perfection. No cooking went wrong. Then another devotee commented, this was the only Sunday feast in which all of us could eat as much as we wanted. Without any limitation on the food or without any digestive problem also. So then the devotees decided to have the finale. They said, let us offer the prasad to the guards. when they went with their mental plates, please have some prasad. So these guys are completely psyched out. No, for all of them, first of all, the very appearance of the devotees was bewildering completely. You know, actually, for them, there was something wrong with the devotees, with everything that the devotees did. Now, in America, the Buddhists, there are many Buddhist people who shave off their head. The devotees would shave off their head, but they would keep something over here. They couldn't figure out what is this. You know, some people wear some sort of plaster on their hands, but the devotees would wear a plaster and a finger would come out of it. So they couldn't figure it out again. And you know, some people, they like to wear animal costumes in which, you know, they have some sort of tail at the back. But in the devotees, the dhoti which they wear, there's a tail in the front and the back both. So they were completely psyched out. So they couldn't understand it. Of course, in the meanwhile, as they were offering this prasad to the guards, at that time, the temple president, he contacted the sheriff and he got the devotees released. So they offered him the prasad and they jubilantly marched out of the prison. So this is wealth of the heart. Wealth of the heart means that actually we are happy irrespective of the circumstances we are put in. So what we get in Krishna consciousness is that not just, of course, as we discussed from the scientific discussion which we had today, Vedic culture provides the physical necessities, but more than the physical necessities, Vedic culture provides us the spiritual necessities which actually make a person happy. See, physical necessities, they are required, but it's not that they make a person happy. They may nourish the body, but what nourishes the heart is devotion. And that is, so this is the complete program for the body and for the soul. That is what we also have an opportunity to participate in when we accept this Vedic culture in our life by chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Thank you all very much for your kind attention. Is there any question? We have a few minutes for questions. Yes, Prabhu.
How can one use one's scientific capacities towards the service of Krishna?
Yeah. Actually, in the Bhagavatam, it is described, first canto, Idam hi pumsas tapasah stutasya sushtasya suktasya cha buddhattayo yad uttama shloka gunanuvaranam. This is all branches of knowledge can be used for uttama shloka gunanuvaranam, for the glorification of the Supreme Lord. So, we can use our scientific knowledge to demonstrate the amazing design that is present in every aspect of science. And then ultimately through that, prove the existence of God and make people God conscious. So that is how we can use science. And that is what in ISKCON, many devotees are doing that. We have a Bhaktivedanta Institute. It is a forum of some of the best scientists all over the world. And these scientists, we have one branch in Juhu, where they are among the only 5-6 institutes all over the world which are offering a MS program in consciousness. Consciousness is like a mystery for modern science. How or why we feel emotions, what is the origin of emotions, feelings, they cannot understand. So they are offering a doctorate, a master's program, as well as a doctorate program in consciousness. So that is there. And similarly in the West, in San Francisco, there is a branch of Bhaktivedanta Institute which has done path-breaking research in understanding human history. They have found, it's a general picture that is portrayed is Darwin's evolution theory. That originally there were unicellular organisms, then multicellular, then ultimately monkeys came, and from monkeys human beings came. But two of the scientists of Bhaktivedanta Institute San Francisco, Richard L. Thompson and Michael Crumo, actually they are devotees also. Richard L. Thompson is Sadaput Prabhu and Michael Crumo is Druta Karma Prabhu. So these two scientists, they have written a book called Forbidden Archaeology, where they have, it's a huge book, 3-volume, almost 3000 page tome, in which they have given scientific evidence of fossils millions of years old of human beings. There are so many fossils like this, but which they have been suppressed. So they have brought it up now. And you know, when they released this book, it created a sensation in America. You know, the NBC, the television network in America, they broadcast the show live. And they showed all the evidences of the anomalous fossils, as they call it, which completely threw overboard the theory of Darwin's evolution. So after this show, the mainstream scientists were enraged. They said that they threatened NBC that we will sue you if you for broadcasting this show. They said that you have to broadcast a primetime apology for broadcasting what is not science as science. But NBC, they saw the scientific credentials of these two people. Now Sadaput Prabhu has done a doctorate from Cornell University, and similarly Duttakarma Prabhu is a doctorate from, I think, Michigan University. So they are, and they are also quoting scientists, that it's not their own data. They are quoting data of reputed scientists whose findings were suppressed. So NBC went one step further, and on prime time, instead of broadcasting an apology, they broadcast advertisement. Watch the TV show that the scientists don't want you to see. And that led to almost 10 times more viewership. So now, Duttakarma Prabhu, Michael Cremo, he's traveling all over the world. And he's completely refuting the theory of evolution. And wherever he's going, he's receiving overwhelming response. In fact, he had come to India also, he had come to Nagpur. The Bharatiya Vigyan Sangathan, they had invited him. They were very impressed. So science can also be used in Krishna's service to counter and refute godlessness. Okay. Any other questions? One more question you can have if there's. Yes, Mataji? Yeah, nice question. Actually, at present, I am studying a book called Searching for Vedic India by Devamrut Swami. Devamrut Swami, he is a doctorate from Yale University. Yale University is a university from which most of the US presidents come. So, in fact, he was Devamrut Swami, he was a batchmate of George Bush. So, he's got a doctorate in sociology, which is one of the most respected fields in Yale University. And he has done comprehensive research into history. So history is generally written by winners. That is a story. So what happens is, you know, Vedic culture was there all over, according to the Vedic scriptures, all over the world. What we talk about, Bharat Varsha, is not just India. It actually refers to the whole world. That's why they say Mahabharat. Mahabharat is the whole world. And Vedic culture was prevalent all over the world. So after the Mahabharat war, which occurred 5000 years ago, the whole Vedic social system got disrupted. And especially with the advent of Kali Yuga, actually what is now the Thar desert, Rajasthan, was actually a lush green land. Because it was through that area that the Saraswati flowed. Saraswati, it is described, it is a river which at the least was 2 miles broad. And at the widest was 12 miles broad. Can you imagine 12 miles broad river? It was such a huge river, and that was what was watering the whole Thar desert area. But with climatic upheavals, the whole Saraswati disappeared, and that's why, as we said, the whole area became a desert. So now, when the scholars read this about Saraswati description, first of all, this idea of 2 mile or 12 mile broad river itself, according to modern scientific understanding, unbelievable. So they declared that this river was mythology. But now, using US and French spacecrafts, France has got a program called SPOT. Using that, they have found within the Saraswati, below the Thar desert, they have found a river bed which is enormous, which is almost like 2-4 miles big. At some places, it is 10 miles big. So, and by correlating with Vedic texts, and with Vedic current archaeology, they have found that it was actually the Saraswati River. So that means what was considered a mythology has now been accepted as fact. So the Vedic culture was prevalent all over the world. It was not just in India. As you say, Krishna is Jagadishwar. What to speak of the world? He is the master of the whole universe. So the message which he gave was actually for the whole world. And of course, the message originated from India, because from the Vedic cultural point of view, India is the land which is most suitable for human habitation. Srila Prabhupada, when he went to America, when he went to London, at that time, one impetuous reporter, he asked him, "Swamiji, is there a description of hell in your scripture?" Prabhupada replied, "London is hell." So that gave us a newspaper headline the next day. So what do you mean that? Reporter was stunned at the cheek of the Swamiji coming into England and telling that London is hell. So Swami said, hell means where there is no sunlight. So your London, the sun never rises. That's why it is hell. Now of course Prabhupada was giving a simplistic understanding. Prabhupada said, the British government would say that the sun never sets on the British Empire. But by the power of time, which is a representative of Krishna ultimately, what has happened? The sun never rises in Britain now. So this is how upheavals occur. So we see this in just, say maybe 100 years ago, Britain was the most powerful country in the world. But now, Britain is now considered a second or third rate power in the world now. So similarly, the Vedic culture was India was the predominating country all over the world 5000 years ago. But with the advent of Kali Yuga, it was all lost. So the point I was making was, India is most suited for human habitation. And that is why all the culture originated from India. And from India, it spread all over the world. So that's why it is not a partiality of Krishna, but this is the center of life on this planet. You know, it is from here that life radiated everywhere. And that's why, because life was central over here, all the messages of the Vedic scriptures were given over here. And another thing is, now from a deeper point, this is from a purely physical point of view. Even from a physical material atmosphere point of view, we see India is very conducive for life. India has abundant natural resources, India the climate is not very extreme. Of course, now as I said, because of the sinful activities, the Thar desert has come up, and some places there are extreme weather. But overall, India is very well endowed naturally for life. And secondly, India is Punya Bhumi. So it requires a certain amount of spiritual credits to be able to understand Vedic knowledge. So in India being Punya Bhumi, souls who have that spiritual credit are born in India. So if I want to give knowledge, there have to be people who are capable of understanding that knowledge. If I start teaching triple integral calculus to a kindergarten student, he will not understand it. So that's why the Vedic culture, the Vedic philosophy is the topmost that can be given only to people of a commensurate caliber. So that is not, again, we are not saying that it is not because we are Indians we are saying India is great. No, India is great because it is Punya Bhumi. It is here that the souls who are most spiritually evolved are born. And it is because the souls are most spiritually evolved in India, then for them the highest spiritual knowledge is given. If you compare the teachings of Christianity or Islam, the teachings are quite rudimentary as compared to the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. They also talk about religious principles, but they are quite basic, whereas the principles taught in Bhagavad Gita are quite advanced. Prabhupada would say, Jesus taught that thou shalt not kill. What was the result? They killed him only. This is the result. You know? So the people were of that caliber at that time. So, if you see the Vedic civilization, people were of a very high caliber. That's why the topmost knowledge was given over here. Did that answer your question? So, I thank you all of you very much. So I'll just briefly summarize, because it was a big discussion. In 2 minutes, I'll summarize and then we'll stop. So, we discussed how the modern attempt to try to artificially gain rains is fraught with great dangers. First of all, there is no correlation that the cloud seeding is producing rains. Secondly, even if it is producing rains, whether it is economically viable is open to question. And third, there can be many unintended consequences of this, which have not been examined. So, the taxpayer is being used to experiment with dubious technology, with himself becoming the laboratory rat. So, of course, people's grievances have to be addressed, but they have to be addressed in a proper way. Now, if people are suffering because they are not paying the cosmic bill, we discussed how much we owe to nature, to sun and to nature. And then we discussed how the Vedic scriptures understand that there is a consciousness behind nature, just as the New Age gardeners, and finding out that by communicating with the spirits in gardening, you can get better output. So Vedic scriptures understand we have to harmonize not just with nature but with God, and that is done through yajna. And yajna is not a waste of resources. The medium of exchange is fire, just as for us the medium of exchange is currency, notes, paper basically. So by performing this, we can harmonize with nature and we can get abundant prosperity. We discussed how we got this in, how this was there in the Vedic culture. Rains would exactly be what was needed at the right time. And then we discussed about further about how we, as people living here, we can become like the healthy cell which transmits health. So by ourselves adopting Vedic culture, we can actually spread the Vedic culture and we can heal society in this way. So I thank all of you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Shrimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Harinam Sankirtan Yagya ki, Tai Gaur Premanande. Hari Hari Bol.